Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. I feel like I got a little cheated last time. I was looking for a proof of God video, and instead, I got a you just gotta feel it in your heart video. So today, I'm looking at a video that actually attempts to address the question, how can we know that God exists? It's from a channel that I've only covered once so far, The Beat by Alan Parr. Hey, that rhymed. I'm a poet, y'all. So let's see if Alan can give us a reason to believe in God.
Hey, my friend, welcome back to The Beat. My name is Alan Parr. Thank you so much for tuning in. If this is your first time here, it's a pleasure. If you want to know the entire story of the Bible, click the link in the description box below.
Now, just hold on a gosh darn minute there, son. You wrote a book called The Bible Story? Is that like a Cliff's Notes version of the Bible? Is the Bible incapable of speaking for itself? But like, this is a summary, meaning that the author of said summary must have thought there was a lot of extra material that could be chopped out without impacting the message, because there's only 35 pages left once the excess is trimmed. Wow. I've made the argument before that the very existence of apologetics books is evidence that the apologists don't think the Bible is sufficient, but I never imagined that I would run across a book that literally does nothing but try to be a more concise Bible itself. This is like the Jefferson Bible, where Thomas Jefferson cut all of the supernatural elements out of the Bible, except Jefferson ended up with 46 pages, so he actually cut less out than Alan here. Well done, sir. Well done.
Okay, so if you've ever wondered the question, I can't see God, I can't smell God, but how do I know if he really exists or this whole thing that we see in our universe is just happening by chance? So,
well, there are more ways to detect something than just sight and smell. I didn't stop believing in God because one day I realized that I couldn't see or smell him. There's a bit more to it than that.
Here are six proofs that I want to give you, and two of them come from the Bible and the other four do not.
Well, here we go. Well, we learned from Pastor Dickie in a previous video that the Bible doesn't actually give proof of God. So there seems to be some disagreement among apologists about what the correct interpretation of God's perfect word should be, which would indicate to me that it is not in fact perfect, as a perfect message can only be interpreted correctly. The potential for incorrect interpretation renders the message imperfect.
The first proof is what we'll call an internal witness.
Oh, is that the little angel that appears on my shoulder and tells me not to do bad things?
Now, this is the idea that deep down inside of every single human being, there is this deep internal sense that there must be a God who exists.
Really? Your opening argument to demonstrate the existence of a God is the tired old, you already know deep down that God exists trope? You're supposed to lead with one of the good ones. Unless, of course, this is another one of those apologetics videos that isn't actually attempting to convince non-believers about their God claims, but rather to reassure current believers, because, really, most atheists will likely tune out as soon as you start to make points that are based on the assumption that you know what's going on in their mind better than they do. A Christian, though, might be encouraged that the existence of atheists doesn't really threaten their faith, because there really aren't any atheists, just people that pretend to be. This is a lousy argument if you actually want to convince people.
I want you to notice here what Paul says about unbelieving Gentiles, not Christians, unbelievers in Romans chapter 1. He says in verse 21, "For although they knew God," so let's stop right there. He says that unbelievers, deep down in their spirit, they know God. They know there has to be a God out there somewhere.
Hear ye, hear ye. Religious guy says that his religion is right, and anyone who disagrees with him is lying to himself. How profound.
Now look at verse 25. What do they do with it? They exchanged the truth about God for a lie. So at some point, an unbeliever, they know in their heart there's a God. They may not believe in Jesus. They may struggle with this idea of there being a savior on the cross who died and resurrected and miracles and fed 5,000. I get that. Okay, fine.
So is this the workaround for the fact that Christianity has never arisen spontaneously?
because I always thought that the "so they are without excuse" part of the chapter was talking about how everyone knows not only that God exists, but that Christianity is the true religion deep down. Because if I know that God exists, but I've never even heard of Jesus and I don't know that Jesus existed, and then I end up in hell, and never having known the way to not end up in hell seems like a perfectly valid excuse to me. It would have to be a knowledge specifically of Jesus and the human sacrifice that Christians must accept, which would mean that if that verse were actually true, Christianity should, at least occasionally, spontaneously arise without missionaries having to bring it to a location first. In fact, I am certain that I am not the first person to have ever thought up this idea. I was delighted when I read the Hyperion Cantos, and one of the side plots involved a Jesuit priest who was intent on finding evidence of Christian civilizations existing outside of contact with humanity, and at one point he forged archaeological data along these lines and ended up being excommunicated. Point is, if this innate God knowledge is just a vague, there is a higher being, then that means people who don't hear about Jesus from other people are with excuse, making verse 20 wrong when it says that they are without excuse.
But deep down inside, even unbelievers have a sense that there is a God, and they exchange that truth for a lie.
And the beauty of that argument is that no matter how much I assure you that I have absolutely zero sense deep down inside me that there is a God, Christians get to dismiss that as me lying to myself and keep going on their merry way, firm in the conviction that everyone believes in God, so they're perfectly justified in believing in God too.
Now, how would they know that internally and intrinsically? Well, verse 19 says, "Since what may be known about God is plain to them." Why? Because God has made it plain to them.
Well, it ain't plain to me. Quoting these verses just comes across as lazy feel-good apologetics. I would like some actual information, if you don't mind.
So basically, Paul is saying, if you just look around, it's very crystal clear that God has done whatever he has needed to do to give every single human being proof of his own existence.
So let's construct a logical syllogism here. Premise 1, the Bible is supposed to be a perfect message to us from God. Premise 2, the Bible says that there is no such thing as a person who does not believe in God. Premise 3, I do not believe in God. Conclusion, the Bible is not a perfect message to us from God. Now, sure, I can't demonstrate to you that premise 3 of this argument is actually true, but now we come to the apparently difficult task of actually believing what people say about what they themselves believe, rather than imposing our presuppositions onto them. Let's just hypothetically say that you're right. I do believe in God, but that belief is deep down inside me and is covered by a lie that I think is the truth. Well, in this hypothetical, you would have to at least acknowledge that I sincerely believe that I do not believe in God, would you not? In that case, do you think that telling me that no, I'm wrong, I really do believe in God, is actually going to convince me? If you told me that you dislike vanilla ice cream, and I responded with, no, deep down you really do like vanilla ice cream, you're just exchanging that truth for the lie of disliking vanilla, would that then convince you that you do in fact like vanilla ice cream? Even if I were right, that likely wouldn't accomplish anything, so maybe stop using this, because even if it's true, you are not going to convince anyone with it.
He's made it plain. God has made it so plain that the Bible says in Psalm 14:1, a fool says in his heart there is no God.
People who don't join the pyramid scheme are stupid. See, it says so right here in the book that they gave me when I joined the pyramid scheme.
So the second proof we'll call the external witness. And this is the idea that not only has God placed it in the heart of every person, deep down intrinsically, that they know that there has to be a God somewhere out there.
Not only has he done that, he actually hasn't even done that. How about that?
But now God has left enough proof externally, specifically in nature, to be able to look around, and anyone with any rational thought should be able to come to the conclusion that, oh, okay, well, because I see this, and because this works this way, and because we have enough sunlight, and we have enough rainfall, and the fact that these stars aren't falling down on the ground. And
you do know what stars are, right? Like, I know the Bible literally says that they can fall out of the sky, but we know now that there is zero danger of that happening, ever, because we know that stars are actually basically other suns that are so far away that they just appear as tiny points of light to us. When I saw this the first time, I really thought I was going to break in with an admonishment against that really bad "just look at the trees" argument. I never thought that I would have to explain what stars are and why they can't just fall out of the sky. And also, I would just like to point out that I'm pretty certain that Alan is not a flat earther, so that is just a really weird statement on his part.
The moon and the sun are spinning around, and the body heals itself whenever we get cut, and all these different things, right? God says, I've left enough proof for you to know that I exist.
Okay, sure, there's nice things like that and all, but what about the eye-burrowing parasites, baby cancer, natural disasters, deadly pandemics? There's plenty of not nice things out there that can't be reasonably attributed to the fall. I mean, sure, they usually are attributed to the fall, but like, really? Tectonic activity wasn't a thing until a human woman ate a fruit and that's when earthquakes started? That means that God had to actively redesign the interior of the earth at the moment of the fruitiness. And somehow he forgot to mention earthquakes in his very explicit curse that describes the consequences of the fall, which aren't even the consequences that he said would be the consequences beforehand. He said the penalty would be death, but instead the penalty was painful childbirth and lack of sexual desire for the woman, or the presence of sexual desire depending on which translation you're reading, and the existence of weeds and thorns for men. And actually, this is one of those spots where the creationist's insistence on a strictly literal interpretation becomes obviously problematic, because in the woman's curse, the word used for desire here is not cut and dry. This passage could actually be cursing women with subjugation under men for their role in the fall. Your desire will be for your husband, meaning that your desires are not your own. They don't belong to you. They belong to your husband. You don't get what you want. Your husband is the final arbiter. It could also mean that women will create problems in the home by trying to control their husbands using desire instead of allowing them to be the head of the house. My point is, and this is kind of irrelevant to this particular video, but this passage could be translated in numerous different ways, and we only have three examples of this word in ancient Hebrew, so we don't really know what the correct interpretation is here.
He says once again in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, for since the creation of the world, God's, here it is, invisible qualities, number one, his eternal power, number two, and divine nature, number three, have been what? Clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse.
Yeah, see? That's the verse I was talking about earlier. Alan here seems to accept that people don't have an innate knowledge of Jesus and his sacrifice, which means that they literally have the best excuse for not accepting Jesus and his sacrifice if they never heard about him in their lifetime. So that directly contradicts your last point. I am genuinely curious, and I know there are different schools of thought on the matter, but what do you think happened to the millions to billions of people throughout history that lived and died without ever even hearing about Jesus? Did they have no excuse and so went to hell because of something that ultimately wasn't their fault? Or do they get a pass because it's not their fault that other humans didn't tell them about Jesus?
God says, listen, when you stand before me one day, I get the fact that you may struggle with understanding who Jesus is and him dying on the cross, but you won't be able to stand before God one day and say, well, God, I just didn't know that you existed, right?
Okay, but not having ever known about Jesus is literally the best excuse for not accepting Jesus into your heart or whatever. So if all these verses mean is that everyone has some innate idea that maybe there's some nebulous God-type being out there somewhere, but there's no details about it, then you can't say that the people who didn't hear about Jesus are without excuse. These are two mutually exclusive positions.
He's left enough proof so that man will be without excuse.
Okay, so far the two arguments for God we have are that everyone already believes in God and look at the trees. Or rather, this new version of look at the trees that is actually look at the stars up there not falling on us. Now, here's the thing. We're only 4 minutes into this 10-minute video. If his first point were true, that everyone already believes in God, then the last 6 minutes here should be completely unnecessary, because we already believe in God, right? But he goes through it anyway in a tacit admission that no, not everybody already believes in God, because if they did, you wouldn't need to make arguments for God's existence. So since atheists reject the premise of your first argument and you feel the need to give additional arguments anyway, why not just skip to the ones that don't rely on you insisting that you know what's going on deep down inside of my heart, which really is probably just a plaque buildup from all the junk food I eat. Is God in my clogged arteries?
Okay, so now these next four proofs are what we'll call the traditional proofs that people have given over hundreds of years, centuries of years.
So the ones that have been around for hundreds of years get to be traditional, but the one from the Bible that is almost 2,000 years old isn't traditional? Aw, poor argument.
And the first one we'll look at is what's called the cosmological argument. And this word comes from the idea of cosmos, or the universe.
If you want to be pedantic, cosmos refers to everything that exists, both within our universe and outside of it. If the multiverse exists, it is part of the cosmos, but not part of our universe. If God exists, as the Christians describe, outside of space and time, then he is a part of the cosmos, but not the universe. The universe is our local instance of space-time, local here being an unknown quantity, as we don't really know how far the universe extends outside of the observable universe.
Now, I'm going to go ahead and read an excerpt from Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology book, which describes it in this way. He says, "Every known thing in the universe has a cause. Therefore, it reasons the universe itself must also have a cause."
I could choose to argue with that, as we don't have anything uncaused to compare the universe to, and our models of the early universe are rather inadequate at the moment. So we don't have enough information to determine whether or not the universe had a cause, or if there is just some aspect of it that has existed eternally, for whatever eternal would mean in a pre-universe situation that likely had no time. But I will hypothetically grant that. The universe had a cause.
And the cause of such a great universe can only be God.
And that's where you lose me. How did anyone make that determination? What is the logic behind that statement? That seems like a huge assumed conclusion. And even if I grant this huge assumed conclusion, that only gets us to deism. A God caused the universe and then, to all appearances, left it to its own devices. That is hardly the Christian perspective on the matter.
Now, let me just kind of break that down in layman's terms. Let's just say we have this phone right here. Well, as we look at this phone had to have a cause of some sort. Something had to cause this phone to be here, right?
Sure. Now, can you explain how a cell phone and the pre-Big Bang universe are in any way analogous?
Or this cup right here, or these glasses right here, something had to cause this to come into existence. And so if we keep tracing the cause back and say, okay, well, what caused the plastic to be on this set of glasses? Okay, then what caused the plastic to be able to be created? Or what caused the resistors in here to be able to be created?
Are you picking specifically human-created things on purpose? Because I can do the same with stuff in nature. What caused this rock formation? Natural processes. What caused this waterfall? Natural processes. No creative force necessary. So, go back to the universe. What caused the Big Bang? We don't know for sure, but can you really rule out natural processes? I think not. We just don't have enough information at this time.
And we keep tracing that cause back to that cause. And who caused that? What caused that? We're basically going to end up with a universe with nothing in it except stars, sun, moon, or whatnot.
No, if you go back far enough, you end up with a rapidly expanding universe that is essentially just a soup of quark, gluon, plasma. And when you get back to the Planck time and before that, that's when the different early universe models diverge, and we don't know for sure what existed then or what state it was in.
And then at this point, we have two options. Option one, God caused the universe that we have today. If you get to that conclusion that God is the source and the cause of everything, then you've already gotten to the place that you need to be.
Yeah, but I don't see any evidence for that option. So far, the answer to the question, what was the cause of the universe, is unknown. Sure, you are welcome to put your God in there as the first cause if you like, but not knowing the answer for sure does not automatically make God a good answer.
Now, the other possibility in terms of how we got our universe is this idea of the Big Bang Theory.
Oh, Alan, no. The Big Bang Theory isn't the other option if we're leaving God off the table. We know the Big Bang is how it happened, back to a certain point when the models break down. But there's way too much evidence for the Big Bang to dismiss it as one of two possibilities, with the other being God. You can fit God into it if you like, but we know it happened.
But then you're stuck there, because if you go with that route, then you have to come up with some sort of conclusion or explanation, if you will, on what caused the Big Bang.
No, you don't. I mean, that would be nice, but being comfortable with saying I don't know when that is the correct answer is an important skill that I think everyone should learn. We do not currently know what caused the Big Bang. This does not mean that we should give up Credit God and stop researching into the matter. Instead, this is a good reason to continue looking into it. Admitting a lack of knowledge in an area is the beginning of a journey to increase your knowledge. Assuming the simplistic answer of God did it, and then concluding that the mystery of God is why we don't understand it, will do nothing but halt your journey into more knowledge.
And then you have to come up with the explanation of who was the person who actually caused it.
Why does it need to be a person? What is your evidence that there was a who involved? Why do you just get to throw that conclusion out there as if it is a given?
And then who was the person who created the two things or however many things that came together to make the Big Bang? And so if you keep tracing those things back, you ultimately get back to there has to be a cause for this.
Okay, sure, I can grant that. The universe had a sufficient cause. Now, how have you determined what properties this cause needs to have had? We haven't had enough experience with universe-causing events to make a determination about the properties that the cause for a universe would have to have, or even if it needs an external cause to begin with.
And that cause is God, who we call the uncaused cause.
An uncaused cause might very well have kickstarted the universe, but why do you just get to assume that it was God? And not just any God, but specifically your God.
Okay, so the fourth argument is called the teleological argument.
Oh, okay, so no connection between the first cause and your God then.
And that comes from the word telos, which is from the idea of end or purpose. Now, this argument, basically, I'm going to read back from Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology book, and he says it focuses on the evidence of harmony, order, and design in the universe, and argues that its design gives evidence of an intelligent purpose.
Okay, so how do we determine that these characteristics are actually indicative of design? Do we have anything that is known to be undesigned to compare it to? I mean, in your worldview, God designed everything, so the answer would be no then, wouldn't it? Well, how can you be sure that only designed things have these properties if you have never been able to compare a designed thing to an undesigned thing in order to determine which properties are exclusive to one or the other?
So the idea of this is one I love. Basically, the idea is if you look at the universe that we have today, it necessitates that there had to be an intelligent design or designer.
I have looked at the universe that we have today. I remain unconvinced of such a proposition.
That everything that we see didn't just come from happenstance, right? The sun being in a position that it is, it doesn't just happen to be there.
I mean, the universe is a really, really ridiculously big place. There are an estimated trillion stars in the Milky Way galaxy alone, and there are an estimated 500 billion galaxies in the observable universe on the low end. The high end estimate is 2 trillion, and this is just the observable universe. So if our galaxy is average, and we have no reason to think that we are special in any way, then that means there are roughly 5 times 10 to the 23rd stars in just the observable universe. If only 0.00001% of these stars are like the sun in all the important qualities that our sun has, that's still 5 times 10 to the 16th sun-like stars, a number so big that I don't even know what to call it, so I have to resort to exponential notation. And this is a ridiculously low estimate, because an estimated 7% of stars in the Milky Way are sun-like stars. And according to recent estimates, there are approximately 0.16 Earth-like planets for every sun-like star. So if we cut that estimate in half, for no good reason other than just being conservative with our numbers, that means there are about 4 times 10 to the 15th Earth-like planets orbiting sun-like stars in the observable universe. We still haven't even gotten down to numbers that I know the names for. And remember, I'm being extremely conservative here. If I use the actual estimates the scientists are giving, these same calculations get us to 5.6 times 10 to the 21st Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. Earth is entirely unremarkable when looking at the universe as a whole.
If it was further away, we would freeze up. If it was closer, we would burn up.
And there are only a few orders of magnitude more than hundreds of trillions of planets that are positioned in such a way. Imagine the impossibility of life happening to form on one of these, thousands of trillions of planets that are positioned correctly to harbor life. And not just any life, but life as we know it. There are potentially a bunch more planets capable of harboring forms of life that we are unfamiliar with. Life exists in at least one of the many, 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 many trillions of places in the universe where life could potentially exist. This is one of the least interesting characteristics of the universe.
There is an intelligent design that placed that sun right in the ideal situation.
And he did it for a bunch of sun-like stars to, what, hedge his bets? You know, like the GameStop people? Too soon?
There's an intelligent design that knows just how much rainfall needs to come down on this Earth, where if it's too much, we'll drown. If it's not enough, we won't be able to survive.
And just how much is the perfect amount of rain? Because there are places on the Earth that hardly get any precipitation, and there are places on the Earth that get a shit ton of precipitation, and everything in between. And life exists in all of these places, almost like that's not some specific factor that's going to be a deal breaker.
There's an intelligence going on that's sustaining everything.
Does everything need sustaining? Is there evidence that points to the idea that if there weren't some force acting, the laws of nature would just suddenly break down for whatever reason? Does God need to constantly fight against the breakdown of the natural laws that he supposedly set up? Was he incapable of setting them up in a way that doesn't require him to sustain them?
Now let's break it down into simpler terms. Let's once again go back to the cell phone.
Yes, let's once again go back to the thing that we know for sure was designed and infer from that that we can therefore determine that everything was designed.
This cell phone is made of batteries, resistors, capacitors, and who knows what else. Plastic, if you will, whatever. So if I just take a whole bunch of parts from a store, if you will.
Don't do it, Alan. Please don't. Just don't.
Radio Shack. I get a whole bunch of parts, batteries, resistors, and I throw them all in this cup.
No, Alan, please. I'm begging you, don't do it. Don't go there. You're better than this. Please, no.
And I just shake them up. Shake them up.
Don't.
Right? I'm not going to be able to take all those parts out and, whoa, pops a cell phone that I can call people all across the world, right? Fuck! Doesn't work like that, right? So this idea of just throwing things together and causing them to bang together doesn't necessarily result, or will not result, in something that is going to work, right?
That depends entirely on your definition of work. We see unguided natural processes forming things all the time. And according to you, everything was designed. The formation of intricate crystalline structures in rocks happens naturally through well-understood natural processes that are unguided. And yet we end up with Cookie Monster geodes. That works. Yes, humans can take these natural things and turn them into devices and whatever for us, but that says nothing as to whether or not natural processes are capable of forming natural things while unguided, and the evidence points to the natural processes having no problem with this sort of thing. And you haven't even gotten to life yet, you're just talking about the positions of the Earth and the Sun, and as I showed earlier, the Earth is far from unique in that respect in the universe.
So the idea is that as we look at our world, as we look at even childbirth, how how babies are born, the miracle of childbirth, and all sorts of other things.
Childbirth is literally a curse, according to your book, and yet you call it a miracle.
There has to be an intelligent designer that is behind all these things that are making it work.
Nope, the birthing process is not intelligent. Childbirth was one of the leading causes of death among healthy young women for most of human history, a fact that is so well known that the Church of England used to have a service specifically for women who survived childbirth, and it had a prayer that thanked God for the safe deliverance and preservation from the great dangers of childbirth. That is not intelligent design.
Now, the fifth argument is what's called the moral argument. And this is the idea that basically inherent in every single person who has ever existed is this idea of right and wrong.
And it varies from person to person and from culture to culture. And you say here that it's inherent in every single person, but there are people born without it. Why does God not give some people his objective moral standard?
Now, do some people go against their own conscience and do wrong? Of course, we all do.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't see the same things as wrong as you do. I don't think sex before marriage is wrong. You probably do. I don't see homosexuality as wrong. You probably do. We both have different moral codes. I'm not going against my conscience when I say that I don't have a problem with the LGBTQ community. In fact, when I was a Christian, I actively fought to separate the idea of being LGBTQ as being wrong from the people people who were LGBTQ because it didn't affect my life, and I knew many people who were members of the LGBTQ community and were perfectly wonderful people. So believing that being LGBTQ was wrong actually went against my conscience, but I tried to do it anyway, even though it felt wrong, because it was supposed to be a part of God's perfect moral code.
But inherently, let's be honest, we all have a common sense of certain things being right and certain things being wrong.
Yeah, there are a few big things that most people can agree on. This does not mean that these things need some external source. In fact, they have a pretty decent evolutionary explanation. As a social species, we are more successful when we follow certain moral codes. So individuals who follow those moral codes had greater success in the society. This even adequately explains why so many people have moral disagreements on the smaller matters that are more nuanced. The selection pressures for these smaller things were not so great, so our morality didn't unite around them quite as well as for, say, murder.
We understand that it is wrong to molest a child.
It's really quite telling that this is often one of the first examples given. Like, the reason our protective instincts toward children are so strong are even easier to explain in terms of naturalistic evolution than our disinclination to murder. So, basically, that is something that is so universally ingrained in our psyches, apologists like to play this card as soon as possible to get the biggest possible response.
We understand that it is wrong to take the innocent life of somebody.
So God was wrong when he killed everyone except for Noah and his family in the flood? He was wrong when he commanded King Saul to kill all the men, women, children, and infants of Amalek? Okay.
We understand all these things are wrong.
And yet they are permitted biblically. Funny that.
Where did that come from?
Evolution. Definitely not the Bible.
Where did this idea of this is right and no, this is wrong come from? It had to have come from God.
Why? Because God demanded that the ancient Israelites go and do things that we all would agree are wrong today?
Because if it didn't come from God, then that means that every single person on earth would have their own separate standard of morality.
Which is pretty much what we observe.
Versus there being a general common morality that is shared amongst all human beings, and that could have only come from a morally perfect being, i.e. God.
That's quite the jump there. Generally, most human beings can agree on some of the more major moral questions. Therefore, the answer to every moral question must have come from a perfectly moral being who is also known to have regularly violated this perfect morality. Yet, I just don't follow that.
Okay, and the sixth and final proof is a difficult one to wrap your mind around, and it's the ontological argument.
God damn it.
And the idea here is, if you can imagine some great maximal being, if you will, right? If you can imagine that being in your mind that can do all these things, that's all powerful, all knowing, that is all sovereign and in control of all things. But if that being only exists in your mind and you're only able to just imagine him, but he doesn't really exist, then that means by default, he can't be the maximum being, i.e. God.
I can imagine in my mind a maximally great unicorn. If this unicorn does not exist in reality, then it's not maximally great. Therefore, this unicorn must exist in reality. That's literally the argument and can be used for a maximally great anything. Also, if I take this argument seriously, then it makes polytheism more likely than Christianity, because more maximally great beings are greater than one maximally great being, so there must be multiple gods. Hinduism looks more likely this way because some sects of Hinduism have literally millions of gods, so that's millions more maximally great beings than Christianity, which maxes out at 3 if we stop pretending that the Trinity doesn't count as polytheism.
There has to be another being out there that is greater than the one that you've actually imagined, because now this being not only exists in your consciousness, but also exists actually in reality as well.
Sorry, but no, you can't just define things into existence.
And so therefore, there has to be a greater God. Basically, the argument is this. If you can imagine that there is a possibility of there being a God, then that means there has to exist the fact that there is a God.
Well, by this logic, I can easily imagine a God that is much, much greater than the God of the Bible. Therefore, the God of the Bible is not the maximally great being. Therefore, the maximally great being that exists is most definitely not the Christian God.
Yeah, I know. That's a tough one to wrap your mind around.
No, it's not tough to wrap your mind around. It's just completely nonsensical. That's it for this one. Sadly, he didn't bring up anything that I haven't heard a million times before, and he did not address any of the many problems with each of the arguments that he brought up. Which, remember, from my video on Brian Holdsworth, Brian's whole thing was that, yeah, there are old responses to the old arguments, but do you really know how they were dealt with, and were they really dealt with? And yet, every time a Christian brings up these arguments, it's in a way that doesn't address any of the objections that are raised against them. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Hama Lama Ding Dong, who says, "As of this moment, downvote 0, upvotes 420. I am a simple man." Indeed. Blaze on. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the maximally great attributes that ensure the existence of my channel. If you'd like to imagine me into existence, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time! You